It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn took more than $500,000 from Turkey and tens of thousands of dollars from Russian interests after being warned in 2014 when he retired as the Army General not to accept payments from foreign governments. Bonnie Watson is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Oversight Committee looking into the influence Russia might have had on last year's presidential election and any connection between the Russian government and anyone on the Trump team. Watson says her committee is not getting very much help from the White House.
Our information is, and it has been reported to us, and we have seen it in writing, the White House does indeed have documents. The White House has determined that it is not going to share those documents. That's not acceptable.
White House spokesperson Sean Spicer answered questions about how Flynn obtained security clearance to be a part of the Trump administration.
General Flynn was a career military officer who maintained a high-level security clearance throughout his career in the military. His clearance was last reissued by the Obama administration in 2016 with full knowledge of his activities that occurred in 2015.
U.S. military says it's probing whether Flynn failed to obtain required prior approval before accepting money from foreign governments in the time that followed his retirement from the U.S. military. The Taliban has unleashed its annual so-called spring offensive in Afghanistan, saying it will mainly target U.S.-led foreign occupation troops to force them to quit the country. It comes a week after the Taliban staged its deadliest ever raid on a major Afghan military base. This is VOA News. One of the key messages coming out of President Trump's meeting with U.S. lawmakers on North Korea was a renewed emphasis on the need to use sanctions and diplomacy to try to pressure Pyongyang back to the negotiating table. And while the outcome of the resumption of talks remains bleak at best, analysts say, China's support is that effort is key. How far Beijing is prepared to go, they say, to tighten the screws and support that effort remains a question. Analysts in China say the government is already doing all it can to keep the North in check. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley ratcheted up her rhetoric against Russia, saying more pressure needs to be put on Moscow to stop the war in Syria.
Russia must live up to its promise to deliver real peace talks and a real political solution. The sieges of the Syrian people must be lifted. The war profiteering and the theft of medical supplies must be stopped. The Syrians in desperate need of humanitarian assistance must receive it.
Haley also said the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad has been emboldened by its continued protection from Moscow. Russia has used its veto 8 times in a 6-year-long conflict to protect the Assad regime from sanctions and from other international action. In a week full of trade discord, President Trump has vowed to take action to boost the American aluminum industry.
The American aluminum industry has been severely damaged by unfair foreign trade. Cheap subsidized foreign imports have flooded into the market, destroying thousands of great American jobs, jobs that are no longer.
Mr. Trump also said the aluminum industry is critical to the defense industry. And on the broader trade scene, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he has urged President Trump not to withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement because he says it would cause a lot of pain on both sides of the border. White House said earlier that President Trump told the leaders of Canada and Mexico in separate phone calls this week he would not terminate the NAFTA treaty at this stage, but would move quickly to begin renegotiating it with them. President Trump is also calling Venezuela a mess after the country announced it's pulling out of the Organization for American States. Caracas government is upset the OAS voted to hold a special session to talk about Venezuela's political crisis. In Washington, a spokesman for the State Department said the OAS has a constructive influence on Venezuela. Anti-government marches in the country have turned violent, leaving at least 29 people dead. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today is Friday, April 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's opposition coalition chooses Raila Odinga as its presidential candidate.
There is no contest here between Brother Raila and between Brother Kalonzo. The contest is between the progressive forces in this nation and those that want to take this country back to those dark days.
That's former Vice President Kalonzo Musyoka, who was also named as Odinga's running mate. Ghana's finance minister says investors are positive about President Akufo-Addo's economic policies. Liberian health officials say the number of cases of a mysterious illness in Sino County has risen to 19, and a court rejects former Chadian President Hissin Habré's conviction appeal.
Habré ruled Chad for 8 years, during which rights groups estimate he was responsible for the deaths of over 40,000 people before he was deposed in 1990. Thursday's verdict marked the end to a more than two-decade campaign by Habré's victims to bring him to justice.
That's reporter Sophia Christensen in Dakar, Senegal, and a Nigerian-American science fiction writer focuses on a space program set in Nigeria. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's opposition has chosen former Prime Minister Raila Odinga as its candidate to face President Uhuru Kenyatta in the August 2017 elections. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
After months of negotiations and uncertainty surrounding the opposition groups in Kenya, they have finally agreed and settled on one candidate to face the incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta. Speaking after being endorsed for the top job, Raila Odinga said it was not easy to settle for one candidate. He says it is an honor to be the presidential candidate of NASA coalition in the coming election. He said after long debate, the opposition reached an agreement that is well documented. 72-year-old Odinga has lost three previous attempts to get the country's leadership. In 2013, he ran against Kenyatta and lost by 800,000 votes. In 2007, Odinga lost against former President Mwai Kibaki in a disputed vote that led to intercommunal fighting that claimed the lives of at least 1,000 people and uprooted about 600,000 from their homes. Former Vice President Kalonzo Musyoka was named Odinga's running mate for the National Super Alliance Coalition. He said the battle is no longer among the coalition.
There is no contest here between Brother Raila and between Brother Kalonzo, or Mudavadi, or Isaac Ruto, or Weta. The contest is between the progressive forces in this nation and those that want to take this country back to those dark days when even the freedom of the press was never guaranteed.
Professor Herman Manyora is a political commentator who says a united opposition stands a chance of winning the presidency.
Anytime the opposition is united in Africa, chances are they will always remove the incumbent from power. The incumbent always thrives on tribalism and divisive elements like religion, which always keep the opposition divided. But the moment they get their act together and work as a team, united, and face the sitting head of state, chances are the sitting head of state always loses.
In the past 3 years, united opposition groups have defeated the incumbents in Nigeria, Ghana and the Gambia. The Kenyan opposition hopes to imitate those countries. President Kenyatta is seeking a second term in office in the August poll. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
An African Union tribunal in Senegal has rejected the appeal of former Chadian President Hissin Habré, who was convicted last year of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Sophia Christensen reports from the courtroom in Dakar.
Malian Supreme Court Judge Ougédé Wafi delivered the verdict on the appeal Thursday. Former Chadian President Hissin Habré's conviction for war crimes, crimes against humanity and torture stands. The court overturned his conviction for rape. Habré will serve his sentence, life in prison. He has been ordered to pay $135 million in reparations to over 7,000 victims and relatives of victims. A few of the 100 victims who testified during the trial were present in the court Thursday. Souleymane Gueng suffered 2 years of imprisonment and torture during the Habré regime. He founded a victims' association in Chad and began gathering testimony of other survivors soon after Habre was toppled in a coup in 1990 and fled to Senegal.
Emotion de satisfaction, de victoire.
Gengeng says he feels satisfaction and victory. But he says now we have to make sure the reparations are paid. This is what I am expecting, and only then will I be completely satisfied. Habre was not in the court Thursday. He had refused to recognize the court's authority, and his lawyers did not take part in the trial. The court-appointed defense said it was not surprised by the outcome of the appeal.
Bah écoutez, je dirais que ma réaction est sans trop de surprise. Hein.
Habre's court-appointed attorney, Mounir Balal, said the judgment was to be expected. My team and I made it a point to focus on the rape charges, and they were dropped. For the rest, nothing changes. Habre ruled Chad for 8 years, during which rights groups estimate he was responsible for the deaths of over 40,000 people before he was deposed in 1990. Thursday's verdict marked the end to a more than two-decade campaign by Habre's victims to bring him to justice. The Extraordinary African Chambers was created within the Senegalese justice systems to try Habre in 2013. It was funded by the international community, and the trial began in July 2015. Chadian lawyer Jacqueline Mudena is lead counsel for the victims.
Oui, je dirais à toute l'Afrique que c'est possible. Tout est possible.
She says the verdict today sends a strong message to all African dictators. It is possible for little people to bring big fish to justice. Watch out, she says. You will no longer remain unpunished. This was a trial of firsts, the first time an African leader was tried on African soil by an African court. For some, the Habre trial could represent a new model for justice as the International Criminal Court faces resistance from some African countries. Reed Brody is an American lawyer who has worked with Habre's victims since 1999.
Je pense pas qu'il s'agisse de remplacer la Cour pénale internationale. Je pense
que he says this is about multiplying the pathways that lead to justice. What is important is to give victims hope and to show them that justice can be made on the African continent. Earlier this week, Habre victims traveled to Banjul to meet victims of alleged abuses under Gambia's former president, Yahya Jammeh, who fled to Equatorial Guinea in January after a regional standoff over the disputed election. Clément Abaye Fouta is the president of the Chadian Victims Association.
Vous savez, nous avons fait une expérience de 26 ans.
He says the Habre ruling is the outcome of 26 years of hard work. Now we are available to help others. We are going to offer our experience to Gambia so they too can find justice. Habre will serve his sentence in Senegal or another country in the African Union. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
Ghana's finance minister says investors were positive in meetings with senior government officials who accompanied Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia to this year's World Bank Spring Meeting in Washington. Ken Afori Atta said investors noticed new energy and hope in a team that is focused on getting Ghana out of its current economic predicament. Afori Atta tells viewers Peter Clotty that President Nana Akufo-Addo's government has been able to outline its plans to jumpstart the economy in just over 100 days. He says the aim is to create millions of jobs as promised.
I think they detected a new energy, a momentum, a sense of hope, and a pretty solid, competent team. We were here with the vice president, the senior minister, a number of other ministers and the technical teams, including the governor of the central bank. So clearly the spirit was different, a team that knew where they were going and focused on getting Ghana out of its current predicament.
So what would you say is the major takeaway as you go back to Accra?
That the world is ready to see the black star shining again, that there is hope that West Africa will become a lot more stable, that Ghana would emerge to the place where it should be among the top countries in the world.
Your party, or for that matter, your government was just given a mandate by Ghanaians 105 days ago or more since your government came into power. What is the current state of the Ghanaian economy?
Well, we came in, I guess, on a platform of change, you would say, and a real hope that we would revitalize the economy and create jobs and there'll be growth. But we met some pretty difficult challenges with regard to fiscal deficit close to 9%, lots of unemployment, growth of 3.6%, which was very low, and then a discovery of some 7 billion CDs worth of arrears that we all did not know about. Foreign exchange was low, and you also had the exchange rate, you know, in a pretty difficult situation. So we had to contend with all of that.
With all these challenges, any specific measures that you plan on implementing based on the promises that the president made to Ghanaians, and how do you intend helping him to keep those promises?
Well, I mean, first of all, as you know, we are in the IMF program. So we had missed all of the targets last year. And the question then is, how do we move back towards those targets? So we had to put together a budget to get through appropriations by March 31st of this year. So that was quite a bit of work. But because of the preparation that we had done and the team that worked, we also really acknowledge the technical competence of the Ministry of Finance, the team there. But it was 24/7 work. And in the end, we decided to create a budget that was both leading towards fiscal consolidation in a real way and also not compromising growth. So we brought down the deficit as a target from 8.7% to 6.5%. We squeaked out the primary balance surplus. We're reducing our debt to GDP ratio from 72.5% to 70.9%, and then increase revenues by 34%. So quite dramatic, you know, sort of contraction in a sense. However, we also were clear that we needed to spur growth. And so one of the more dramatic things was to abolish about 14 taxes, which the senior minister termed to be nuisance taxes.
Ken Oforiatta is Ghana's finance minister. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, April 28th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Liberian health officials say the number of cases of a mysterious illness in the country's southeastern Sino County region has risen to 19. 10 people died mysteriously last weekend, and about 9 others seriously ill after attending the funeral and repast of a religious leader. Liberia Chief Medical Officer Dr. Francis Carter told VOA yesterday that experts have ruled out Ebola as the cause of the mysterious sickness and deaths. In an update, Dr. Carter says of the 9 people that were hospitalized, 3 have been discharged and 6 others remain hospitalized with 3 in critical condition. He says samples collected from both the dead and the sick are being sent abroad to determine the source of the strange sickness.
Personally, the latest norm is that there are 9 confirmed cases. In 2018, we had 10 and personally 3 were discharged today, and there are 6 in the hospital. Out of the 6, 3 of them are stable and 3 are critical. In terms of following up on the source of this nightmare, basically, we have gathered some samples, and we are in the process of trying to send these samples to other countries, since we do not have the capacity in-country to analyze some of the samples. So we are looking at what could be the possible causative pathogen that will lead to these kind of signs and symptoms.
Dr. Carter, so the main source of this event is still the funeral and those who attend the funeral and the repast.
That is so true. About 95% to 96% of the cases that we are dealing with, there is a linkage to the funeral repast. And the others, we are not too sure whether other things that came from the repast or whether they went around the repast, because there were 2 or 3 of them that died in the community. And so those ones were not interviewed or know where they went and so forth.
So no one else living in the other communities, I mean, as far as you know, has been affected?
Yes, as far as I know, no one else from any of the communities that did not attend this funeral repast, you know, have been infected by this disease.
I was reading a World Health Organization advisory to its staff, and it kind of scared me. For example, avoid contact with any person sick or any contact under follow-up from the affected communities. All staff should follow universal precautions, including hand washing, and avoid drinking unprotected water and food. This kind of advisory reminds me, or is reminding people, of Ebola.
Yes, the thing here is that, you see, when you have to be on the side of caution when these things happen. Up to now, we have not identified the pathogen that is leading to death. Definitely, we are on the side of caution, trying to caution people that, look, let us go back to those things that helped us during the time of Ebola. And so those things that we did was basically basic hygiene, not getting into contact. Even from what we've seen, nothing has been transmissible from person to person. We have not seen that. But stayed on the side of caution. So I'm sure this is why WHO is putting that hope.
I know you talked yesterday about preliminary testing. Are you awaiting results?
Like I said, Ebola, we have done the Ebola testing, and it shows that we are not dealing with Ebola. So definitely we looked at one source, looking at very high metal in the water. So we have done those testing, water samples and other tests and so forth, just to rule out the probability of what be the source of this disease that we are dealing with. But we have gotten specimens from the patients, both those alive and those that died, and we're trying to send some of these specimens out of the country to do further testing.
Dr. Carter, thank you very much again for talking with us under these circumstances.
You are welcome, James. Thank you so much for following up.
Dr. Francis Carter is Chief Medical Officer of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Human rights activist Justina Mukoko says she decided to write a book about her harrowing experiences in the hands of Zimbabwean state security agents in order to expose the traumatic encounter. Mukoko was abducted and tortured by members of the country's feared spy network known as the Central Intelligence Organization for exposing human rights violations in the 2008 general elections. Mukoko, who returned to Zimbabwe this week, says she feels relieved after writing the book. She spoke with Gibbs Dube of VOA Studio 7 program about her book entitled The Abduction and the Trial of Justina Mukoko, The Fight for Human Rights in Zimbabwe.
I had come to speak to students in four colleges. I went to Beloit and University of Wisconsin in the Midwest. That was my first time to be in the Midwest. I also went to Colby in Maine. I stayed at Colby as an Oak Fellow in 2010. Yeah. That's where I got an opportunity for respite after my ordeal in 2008. And I was back at Colby because the seed to write the book was actually sown at Colby. And I'd gone back to say, that seed had germinated, and I wanted to share that joy with them.
Now, the book, the abduction and trial and whatever of Justina Mukoko, is something that is very deep, you know. I actually read the book. So at the end of the day, it seems as if you're actually expressing your kind of inner self.
I needed to do that, Gibbs, because that was a traumatic experience, and I just needed to offload all that bad vibe that went with that experience. And I thought by putting all that in a book, it would actually leave my story for the future. No one will tell my story on my behalf. I have told my own story.
That was Zimbabwean human rights activist Justina Mukoko speaking with Gabe Dube of VOA Studio 7 program. Deji Olukotun is an American-Nigerian author whose work focuses on space programs set in Nigeria. His first book, Nigerians in Space, was a thriller based on a Nigerian scientist. He spoke with Ricky Stryak about his new book entitled After the Flare, which will be released in September this year.
I thought it would be very interesting to explore issues like ambition, issues like immigration, and then use the space program kind of as a metaphor to talk about how Nigerians specifically could achieve their dreams and, you know, whether that was possible today in an age where we've been to the moon. What happens when someone from a developing country has dreams too, and how do those dreams get realized?
Did you dig deep into the realities of the Nigerian space program while researching your books, and what did you find?
In 2006, when I was researching, the inspiration came from a book funded by NASA about the lunar rocks that had been taken back from the moon, from the Apollo moon missions. Only when I was pretty far along in the book did I realize that Nigeria did have a space program. Still, the information was pretty scanty at the time, so I was able to learn a little bit about they had sent what they called the first astronaut up in space, which was actually a young woman who flew in a parabolic flight, which is kind of those flights that simulate gravity. But not too much information. I think now there's a lot more that's come out.
Your next book that's coming out after The Flare, what is it going to be about?
It's a sequel to Nigerians in Space, and it's near future, so set sometime in the near future. And the premise is that there's been a solar flare that knocks out electronics infrastructure and shifts the places in the globe where technology can be used and made. So that just based on the where the flare hits, countries in the north and countries in the south lose their infrastructure. But meanwhile, there are some astronauts who are stranded up on the International Space Station.
That was Deji Olukotun, an American-Nigerian author who focuses on science fiction. He spoke to Ricky Stryak from Lagos. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the appointment of Nabil Maloul as the new national head coach for the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia. The 54-year-old was appointed as the Tunisian national team manager to succeed Polish manager Henry Kasperczak, who was sacked a couple of weeks ago after the national team was eliminated in the quarterfinals of the 2017 African Cup of Nations last January. Maloul's first game in charge will be against the Egyptian national team on Tuesday, June the 6th in Tunisia. Meanwhile, former Egyptian boss Hassan Shahata has resigned as Petrojet manager in the wake of his side's 1-0 defeat at the hands of relegation-threatened Nasir Tadin in the Egyptian league on Thursday. The decorated Shahata, who led Egypt to an unprecedented hat-trick of Nations Cup titles in 2006, 2008 and 2010, had been in charge of the Petroleum side since mid-January. And now to another coach, this time around Nigeria's Super Eagles handler Garrett Rao, who has requested the Nigeria play friendly matches against teams placed higher in the FIFA rankings. General Ross's request will enable the team to improve their standings on the FIFA rankings, an important factor when it comes to seeding for major international tournaments. Nigeria have already overlooked Congo Brazzaville, ranked 84, in favor of higher-ranked Burkina Faso, ranked 35 when it comes to their next friendly. Staying with Nigeria, foremost energy solutions company AITO Group on Wednesday signed a 5-year partnership agreement with the Nigerian Football Federation, which has conferred on the company the title of official optimum partner of the NFF. The financial obligation to AITO Group is valued at $9.2 million for the next 5 years. The partnership, which is the first in-country sports sponsorship for the energy giant, will start on the 1st of May 2017 and has an initial option of 1-year extension. The energy group, as part of the deal, has concluded an arrangement to pay all Nigerian national football team coaches salaries for the next 5 years with 500 million naira annually. On a rather sad note, Gabon Football Federation, FEGAFOOT, has announced the news of the death of the country's former international, Moise Barrow Apanga, who died on Wednesday from a suspected heart attack. The 35-year-old collapsed during a training session with his Gabonese club FC 105 Libreville. Barrow Apanga made 33 appearances for the Panthers and represented the Central Africans at the 2010 Nations Cup and the 2012 event on home soil. In baseball news, Pittsburgh Pirates rookie Gift Ngobe became the first African-born player to appear in a Major League Baseball game midweek and marked his debut by getting a hit in his first at-bat. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Kenya's opposition has chosen former Prime Minister Raila Odinga as its candidate to face President Uhuru Kenyatta in the August 2017 elections. And an African Union tribunal in Senegal has rejected the appeal of former Chadian President Hissène Habré. That's it for this Friday, April 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the latest political developments in Zambia. Will President Edgar Lungu declare a state of emergency after public buildings were torched in attacks? He blames the violence on opposition members protesting the arrest of their leader, Hakainde Hichilema. an in-depth discussion on Zambia on the next Straight Talk Africa.